On today's episode, we are talking about the McAllisters, Christmas pickles, and Belschnickel as we go down the rabbit hole of Christmas traditions. This is Penhold Talk Radio. Welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us and spending some of your holiday time with us. Merry Christmas. My name is Brian Constein. I am here with my co-host, Michael Rowland.
Hello, hello.
So we've tackled some heavy subject matter over the last couple episodes. Today, prepare for a hard right. We are going into the light and trivial today. And I guess this is probably going to be the last episode before Christmas and into the new year. And if you've been with us for all 10 episodes now, this is the 10th one. Thank you. This has been a fun experiment that we've engaged on.
Yeah.
We don't know how this is going to turn out, but it's been a fun little journey that we've tried out, and we'll see what the new year brings. But since this is the last one before Christmas, we decided to look at take a Christmas theme approach to today. And you know how YouTube is really good at roping you into watching the next video.
You start out watching a movie trailer and wind up watching some video teaching you how to talk to an animal. You can wind up down quite the rabbit hole.
Yeah. You just never know what you're going to end up finding or what the YouTube algorithm is going to shoot out at you.
Yeah.
They seem to have it pretty good though. It takes some self-control sometimes, to stop that. But, this time I went with it, but not with YouTube. I went with it more with Christmas theme and more with Wikipedia. We'll get to that a little bit later. But Wikipedia is really good for getting you to click on the next link.
Yeah, they feed you the links throughout the article, and so you see something of interest in one, and it draws you into the next, and you can find quite the chain of information.
Yeah, it's quite fun. Like I said, we'll get to more of the Wikipedia side of things in kind of the second part of the episode. But yeah, it's you look at a Wikipedia article, and you start on one subject, and it's so convenient because they mention something interesting, and it's usually in the nice blue hyperlink. It's like, yep. Oh yes, I can find out more about that exactly. Yep. And you click on it, and all of a sudden there's a whole new area for you to explore and discover and be distracted by, and then have to remember what you actually started looking up in the first place. But so today, the first rabbit hole we want to go down is Christmas movies. And since it's middle of December, I'm sure you've all kind of broken out your Christmas stash of movies. I don't know what ours usually gets stored in the basement underneath the stairs, and then get brought out usually mid November. What's the proper starting time for Christmas movies?
I used to treat it as December 1st. It was always you wait until December, all the Christmas stuff waits till then. I'm finding more and more with kids, I'm okay with pushing that a little bit sooner, getting them excited about it. I'm okay with starting kind of that mid-November, late November kind of time frame.
Yeah, it's probably closer, a little bit later. It depends on when it comes to the Christmas movies. Some of them don't feel like you can watch them until December, though. You might break them out, but like for me, White Christmas has always been one of my favorite, one of the Bing Crosby, Danny Kaye movies. But that one, it doesn't feel like you can watch it too early, or like the Grinch movies, ones that are like explicitly Christmas.
Yeah.
It feels like it has to be December, and best if it has snow outside or something like that. It doesn't feel like you have permission to, but other ones, you know, I'm thinking, let's see. Can we say Die Hard?
The Christmas adjacent movies where like Die Hard, it happens during Christmas. Yeah. It's a work Christmas party, but it really doesn't have anything to do with Christmas.
Yeah.
That's just kind of the context.
Yeah.
Of
I mean, they're kind of like lead-ins. They're not full fledged maybe. But, and this is a little off the script that we're kind of, but, I wish I didn't look it up, But there's a guy on YouTube. I think he's part of a larger channel. I forget, Film Joy or something like that. But he has his own little kind of subset of videos called Movies by Mikey or Movies with Mikey. Hmm. And he does these kind of video essays on different movies, whatever he decided to make a movie on. But he'll do like a 20-minute video essay on, say, John Wick and why he likes John Wick. And it's kind of a little zany and off the wall. But he did one last year where he like rated, he came up with a movie rating scale to determine how Christmas-y the movie is.
I think I saw a little bit of that.
And so there's like 20 movies, but he's got like a checklist of, you know, 12 different criteria on some sort of scale.
Right.
You know, how much Christmas is referenced? Is there a tree involved? What time does it happen? Is there a Christmas theme that's kind of central to it? Yeah. It's funny in one part that the guy spent so much time thinking about this.
Yeah,
but he does a very entertaining job of it. And Die Hard actually comes up higher on the list than you actually think it does on his criteria, which are quite, you know, reasonable criteria.
Yeah,
for how kind of zany and out there the whole video is. But that's just a side note. If you're interested in exploring the kind of the justification for movies like Die Hard, whether they're in there or not. And he mentions other movies that I have never seen and certainly hadn't seen in connection with Christmas. But anyways, when it comes to breaking out the Christmas movies, is there one that is first or primary, or maybe one that you anticipate watching the most?
It's typically those Christmas specials. So the Charlie Brown, mm-hmm. the Grinch, that whole genre, or the Mickey Mouse. What am I thinking here? Christmas Carol. Yeah. Mickey's Christmas Carol and Muppet Christmas Carol. All those just like little short kids, like half hour specials.
I was going to say, was that a recent thing, say, since kids came on the scene?
No, not entirely, because I grew up with that. Like, we'd watch those almost every year. And so it's just kind of something that stuck.
Yeah.
So those tend to be kind of the go-to. Once we're breaking out Christmas stuff, we got to make sure we watch The Grinch and Charlie Brown and so on.
Yeah. Yeah. The Mickey Mouse never hit our scene, but obviously all the TV kind of specials.
Yeah.
We're central. Kind of really the only Christmas tradition when it came to the movies growing up for me was watching How the Grinch Stole Christmas on Christmas Eve.
Oh yeah.
Like the original Boris Karloff one. That was we'd watch that on Christmas Eve and, you know, open our one present that night and then off to bed kind of thing. But other than that, that was kind of the main family one. For me, for a number of years, the first one, and in my teen years, my bedroom was downstairs in our place, and it was, I also had three other brothers. It was a huge room, so it had enough for me and my, I think all three of my other brothers were in there. Four boys in there. And we would hang Christmas lights around the outside and then Christmas music blaring and that kind of thing. But I also had a TV down there, and one of the first movies Christmas movies that I always went to was White Christmas again. That just to me is just a quintessential Christmas one. I like, you can actually argue it's not super Christmassy.
Yeah.
It has a name in it, but overall it's not central about Christmas,
yep.
But it has obviously I love the songs and the music to it. Has a fun little story. Danny Kaye, if you don't know who Danny Kaye is, look him up. He's just a crazy, comedic singer dancer.
Yeah. He's really fun to watch.
Yeah. The other one that he's in. Oh, Now I'm gonna mess myself up because I can't remember the other movie I have him in, the other singing and dancing one. Oh, well, maybe Michael can find it up. But yeah, over, in more recent years, it's always kind of interesting to see what kind of new Christmas movies come out. Cause to me, when I think Christmas movie, I think of older movies. I think most of us do.
Yeah. There's that certain subset of like the classic Christmas movies. It's a Wonderful Life, White Christmas. You've kind of got that era of movie that we all think of.
Yeah. Yeah. Like those are going even further back. But yeah, when you think of Christmas movies, it's not like you're thinking of something from like the past 10 years. Like it feels like it feels like, you know, when I think of Christmas movies, I go back to those other ones. Yeah. Like, you know, Home Alone is a Christmas classic now. It's 30 years old, by the way.
Yeah.
Like maybe the most recent Christmas movie that I have kind of in the Christmas collection. Oh, yeah. We got Love Actually. I forget how old that one is. That one's probably even pushing 20 years.
It's getting up there.
It does mention, the opening scene dates it to probably 2002.
Yeah, it's early 2000s.
Something like that. But yeah, there have been a couple more recent ones that have kind of made their way into the Christmas collection. For me, Arthur Christmas.
I have yet to see that. I haven't seen it yet.
I would highly recommend that. That one's especially good with the kids. It has to do with Santa and his two sons. So there's one and it's Santa's gone high tech. So he flies around in this like cloaking spaceship to get around. But there's also Grandfather Christmas in there who's kind of old fashioned still. He remembers the old fashioned way.
Right.
So there's like four generations of possible Santas here. And so the older brother is kind of expecting to take the reins, and then you got the younger one who's kind of got more of that Christmas spirit kind of attitude, and it's whether or not who's going to, it's kind of like trying to figure out who's going to, how's Christmas going to play out in the future? What kind of direction is it going to go in?
Right.
And it's really well animated for that one. The other one that I want to recommend is The Man Who Invented Christmas.
I did see that one. I really enjoyed that movie. That one was really good.
Yeah, I saw this one in theaters. I guess it came out 2 years ago, I want to say.
Might be three years.
Wow. This was a surprise one for me because I went into the theater not really having huge expectations, but thoroughly enjoyed this one. This one's about kind of the story behind Charles Dickens and the writing of The Christmas Carol and kind of how that came about, what kind of work the conditions in his own life that kind of fed into it. But what I really found fascinating was how they portrayed his kind of writing process and story conceptualization and how he's looking for characters, not in the sense he's creating them, but he's really looking for these characters in the sense of discovering them. And particularly he's trying to think up the character that would become Scrooge. But he really doesn't have Scrooge the character until he comes up with his name. And so you see him struggling with what kind of name does this guy have? And that really just sets it off. And then these characters kind of come to life. But that kind of, you see kind of a parallel between his real life and his kind of writing life and how those are kind of meshed together and woven together. And it really is an entertaining movie. That's worth checking out. I think it would be considered a family movie. It just wouldn't, I don't think the younger kids would be too interested in it.
Yeah.
Certainly if, your 10-year-olds and up, I think could watch through something like that.
I don't remember it being anything that's too intense or too inappropriate in any way. It just might be above the young kids. They wouldn't understand and wouldn't enjoy it.
It'd be more of an interest level kind of thing.
Yeah, for sure.
All right.
Another one we watched a couple years ago now, and our kids loved it. It's a great family movie. Was Noel. It's just a fun, it's got Anna Kendrick in it.
Okay.
It's just a fun one where she's the daughter of Santa Claus and her brother's supposed to be taking over as Santa, and things go wrong, of course. And it's just a fun, cute family movie. And it was really,
yeah.
really enjoyable. Never I gotta put it in that one. Similar class to like the Santa Claus. It's just goofy, magical, fun story. But yeah, it was definitely a good family friendly one.
Now, a couple of weeks ago, I kind of teased some facts about Home Alone. And so I compiled these to fulfill that promise. So I compiled a list of a kind of a little trivia about Home Alone. For me, this is a Christmas classic. I don't know what it is. It is every you know every beat, you know every aspect of it, you know all the traps, you know all the gimmicks that they put into it. And yet it is just completely rewatchable. Like I never get bored watching it.
Yeah.
One kind of little trivia right off the top. I came across this. I didn't know this one beforehand, but this is a very popular in Poland still. In Poland, they have this movie airs on Christmas Eve, I think on one of the local stations there. And it still attracts a huge audience. It was played there. Let me see here if I can find it again. Here it is. Home Alone. It's played on a local TV station there. In 2010, they didn't play Home Alone. And over 90,000 people protested on Facebook about it. In 2016, 4.4 million Poles tuned in to watch it.
Wow.
And so it's very popular still.
I guess once you develop that tradition,
it
becomes something people just do.
Yeah. It's their tagline now is Christmas without him. It's absolutely impossible. Referring to Kevin, I guess, the McAllisters and everyone else there. There's the first bit. So it came out in November 1990, and it's written by John Hughes. And if you're not familiar with John Hughes, you know his movies. He's incredibly prolific in some of the popularities of these movies. Actually, Home Alone, Breakfast Club, 16 Candles, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, Uncle Buck, Ferris Bueller's Day Off. I haven't watched that one. He also wrote Christmas Vacation, National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation.
He apparently actually started the entire National Lampoon's Vacation series. There was actually something prior that apparently he wrote a short story and they based the entire thing off John Hughes' work.
Yep.
So he has quite the credits to his name.
Yeah. So these are late 80s. Into the 90s kind of hits that are just completely rewatchable and become really kind of cultural landmarks as far as movies go. So John Hughes wrote it, and initially Warner Brothers was going to produce it. And initially John Hughes quoted them $10 million. But as things got on, he quickly thought that this might go beyond it and wasn't sure Warner Brothers were going to be happy with that. So he actually secretly went to Fox Studios. Fox Studios. And asked them if it falls through with Warner, would you guys pick that up? So he actually got them a script when this is against movie protocol and like I think probably legal requirements when it comes to legal.
Yeah, you can't just be passing it around every studio you've already signed on.
Yeah. And so he had kind of a backup plan, and in fact it did go over. So he said $10 million. This is 1990, so $10 million. This is still still a low amount for movies at that time. And it started going over to about $14 million. Warner Brothers said pare it back a little bit. The director didn't necessarily people making the movie said, no, we can't do that anymore. We can't pay her back. Warner Brothers basically closed the book on that. They shut down production on it. And it was like the next day, Fox Studios says, we'll take it. And so in total, I think it costs $18 million to make.
Man, I bet Warner's regrets that decision.
Yes, but only in hindsight. We'll get to that. Cause I know like, no one knows what this little thing is going to be like. This is a kind of a silly Christmas movie, and it's John Hughes, so you know he's got some credibility, but still, you know, you can't expect this to be you know, blockbuster or anything like this. It ended up being directed by Christopher Columbus, again, another actually name that you're probably familiar
with.
He's
a big time director.
Yeah. Christopher Columbus, he directed this one, Home Alone 2. He actually directed the first two Harry Potters.
Really?
And he's still, I think, a producer on those. So he directed those. He's a producer on Jingle All the Way.
Oh, yeah.
So Christopher Columbus, and kind of production studio is 1492. So when you see that pop up at the beginning of, I remember it popping up at the beginning of Jingle All the Way. That's how I saw it. But yeah. He wrote The Goonies and Gremlins. Those in the '80s. Yeah. So
those are iconic 80s movies.
Yep. Christmas Chronicles 2, as I remember my IMDb searching. Christmas Chronicles 2, he directed that one as well. That's the Netflix one from a couple of years ago, or last year actually. So Christopher Columbus gets on board. He had the chance to direct Christmas Vacation the year prior, but he didn't like the way Chevy Chase was treating him, so he backed out of that. And so John Hughes came and gave him the possibility of writing or of directing this movie of Home Alone. So this movie is released out in November of 1990, and it earned $16 million in its opening weekend, which is not too bad. You actually kind of almost get back your investment, yeah. But it's not a ton. It is number one in the box office that year or that week. It proceeds to be number one at the box office for 12 weeks in a row. And it doesn't get bumped off number one in the box office until February, I think it says, middle of February of 1991.
Wow. That is quite a stretch.
Yeah, let's see here. At the beginning, so it gets bumped off at the beginning of November or beginning of February 1991. So think about it, this is a Christmas movie, like explicitly Christmas. It launched November, stays number one for 12 weeks in a row, and then it remains in the top 10 until April 26th. So past Easter, this little budgeted Christmas movie runs in the top 10 until the end of April. And in fact, it even crops back up into the top 10 at the end of May and then the middle of June.
Wow.
Like this is like one of the weirdest, I'm sure this is gonna be one of the weirdest box office stats of any movie. Like a movie just does not pop up again.
No.
Especially a Christmas movie in the middle of June. But it had a theater run of almost 200 days. And in that time, it grossed domestically $285 million. just in the US alone. Worldwide, it hit almost $480 million.
That's absolutely remarkable. Like you look at big movies now and what they're putting into them, the hundreds of millions of dollars. Their return on investment has absolutely nothing on Home Alone.
No,
like you look at what they invested to what they got, and just unbelievable success.
The $285 million that it grossed domestically was the second highest of any movie ever to that point. So up till 1990, the only two that were above it were Star Wars, the first one, and E.T. They're the only ones of any movie.
Who would have guessed what's ultimately a pretty kind of goofy, almost like slapstick kind of Christmas movie would pull that off?
I know, this would be just a fascinating thing or thing to study. Like, why did this movie succeed in this way? I think my interest on some of this got triggered because Netflix did a little series on, I think, the movies that made us. I think that's what the series is called.
Yeah.
The movies that made us. And one of the episodes was on on Home Alone and just some of the incredible stats that went on and some of the production issues that were on there. So that $285 million that it earned domestically just in the United States was actually the highest earning domestic take at the box office of a live action comedy until 2017. So it made more movie. So as a live action comedy in the live action comedy genre, and that's not a small category.
No,
that made that held the record for the most money earned domestically by a live action comedy until 2017, when a Chinese movie broke that record in China. It's $476 million worldwide, was the highest grossing live action comedy ever until 2011, when The Hangover Part 2 broke that record.
How? I get that it's a great movie, but how do you hold a record like that?
Yeah, I know. Like this is like the treasure trove of treasure troves when it comes to like box office success. Like I don't think anyone had any anticipation of this. Like this is crazy. And the last one I'll throw out there, it was the highest grossing Christmas film ever until 2018, when the animated The Grinch movie came out. So
that, like, that's the one that just came out a few years ago.
Yep,
that
2018.
Illumination Studios one.
Yep. So up until then, as far as Christmas movies went, Home Alone was king of the heap there.
Oh my goodness.
When it came to box office success. I don't know. Like I said, I liked Home Alone before. I don't remember it coming out. I was seven, I guess, when it came out. And I don't remember the time when I first reckon or knew about it. At least as far as my memory goes, it's kind of before when I started paying attention to that. But when you look at kind of the stats here, I liked it, but a lot of people have liked it and liked it a lot.
Yeah.
At that time, like 67 million tickets were sold in the United States for this movie. During the theater,
that is incredible.
last thing here is it didn't do too well in home rentals when it was released on rentals. It's because everyone bought it.
Yeah,
they people ended up buying the movie, and so they made like another $115 million in home sales afterwards. So like this was it. Like if you were a director, I'm sure. Like Christopher Columbus, like I think this was the third, at least according to kind of the IMDb page, like this was the third movie he directed. Like he could have walked and been done, like at the age, I think, of 32, he could have been done with probably the money he
massive got off success. This.
But yeah, just incredible. Like I said, we're going down the rabbit hole. This was one rabbit hole that I just found fascinating when it came to a movie that we're all familiar with, but there's a lot of kind of fun background stuff to when this came out. If you're listening to this, may let us know if you watch this in theaters, if you're one that remembers this when it came out, and whether kind of the popularity, if you remember the popularity at the time, because yeah, even now, these numbers would be incredible for any movie, Marvel or otherwise.
Absolutely.
But for a movie that one studio passed up. Because it went $4 million over budget, $4
million on an already $10 million budget. As far as movies go, even at the time, that would be a low budget.
Yeah.
Now it's a Christmas movie.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to sink $100 million into a Christmas movie. It's just
at least
not,
at that time, yeah.
It's not going to have the return. Or at least you wouldn't anticipate the return on investment, but yeah, a few million over and they dropped it. Biggest mistake they could have made, but
yeah, it just
who could have guessed?
Incredible. So there is the Christmas movie rabbit hole for you. So moving on to our second rabbit hole, and the origin for this one, what got me going down this one was I was filming a Christmas special. Not that feels more lofty than what it really is, but I'll plug it anyways. I was filming a little Christmas special for Roy Mitten and his ministry, Your Thriving Family.
Yeah,
we interviewed him a couple episodes ago, but we're putting that together. And we were at, I'll throw another plug in for Parkland Nursery and Garden. We're filming up there and they had some Christmas ornaments on there, that they're for sale. And one scene that's going to end up getting cut from the special is Roy picking out, an ornament, and particularly, the Christmas pickle ornament.
Oh, are you
familiar with the Christmas pickle?
Vaguely. Okay. I've run into a few people that talked about the Christmas pickle thing, and all I know about it is it's somehow tied to German heritage of some kind, and it's something about hiding a pickle.
Yeah. So, so how recent then have you come across this? Because for me, like, maybe if I think hard enough, maybe I've heard about it, some rumors in the past, but maybe on the last couple of years. But this is the first time I could say yes.
I think the first time I remember hearing about it was probably about 4 or 5 years ago.
Okay.
It's not a long time ago, but I don't know. I heard about it before too. It's just never stuck.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, I don't know how widespread. Let us know if you have a Christmas pickle on your tree. But anyway, so this got me down this rabbit hole. This is what started it. And yeah, so generally, I guess the tradition is that the pickle is hidden on Christmas Day somewhere on the tree, usually, I think. And then whoever finds it, usually gets an extra present or gets to open the first present. Maybe it's less or a little more abstract, and then, you know, you just get it's going to be a good year for you if you find the Christmas pickle. At least that's kind of the tradition that most people have when it comes to this. Now that's interesting, but trying to figure out the origins is another thing. This thing is hard to pin down where this whole thing started. You would think that it'd be peculiar enough that people would say, okay, yeah, this is the first guy that decided to use a pickle and associate with Christmas. Like, who does that?
Yeah.
But no, there is no consensus on it. There's a variety of different traditions. The common, at least the initial thought, was that this was German, a German tradition. And yet when Germans were asked about this tradition, I think only 8% actually knew what this was, what this whole pickle thing was.
Yeah.
And then only 2% of Germans actually incorporated it into their festivities. So it's certainly not a mainstream German thing. There's some thought that maybe it's kind of more localized to kind of the German Polish border kind of area. But one tradition is that this started kind of becoming a thing during the American Civil War. So there's a Bavarian Civil War soldier who was captured. I can't remember what side this was on, but he was captured, and he got to the point where he's near starvation and he's begging his captives for a pickle. And having mercy on him, the captives provided him with the requested gherkin, and the soldier credited that pickle with saving his life. And so that's maybe the Bavarian connection, German connection thing going on there, and that's kind of spread out from there. But Civil War, perhaps that was one origin. The other one, though, that I find much more interesting, and put me down in a completely different channel in this rabbit hole, and into a kind of a corner that I think even Lewis Carroll would appreciate. Like, there's some strange characters down this way. Another tradition for the Christmas pickle is that originates with kind of this story of three kids, and they end up. It's either the story goes that this is either a butcher or an innkeeper that they have to find some sort of lodging with. And so they proceed to stay with this butcher / innkeeper. Some of the story says that perhaps this is during a famine. And so the butcher / innkeeper proceeds to cut up these kids. and put them into a pickling jar. And he's going, the plan is he's going to sell them for money during this time of famine. And so there's your pickle connection, but the story doesn't end there. The legend goes that Saint Nicholas, the Saint Nicholas, comes onto the scene, discovers what the butcher has done, and actually raises the kids back to life and sends them on their way back home. And as a result, this evil butcher innkeeper repents of his errors and proceeds to become a companion with Santa. This is the tradition that's kind of emerged out of this. And just to stop on, before we chase Santa's evil butcher, reformed, I guess.
Reformed evil butcher.
Before we follow his story, the Saint Nicholas, and he's the patron saint of like 15 different things. Two of them are he's a patron saint of children and brewers, like liquor,
beer.
Yeah. And part of it is based upon this story, or at least kind of the distortions of the story as they went forward, because obviously you can see why he's called the patron saint of children, based on this story, as he's rescues these children from their fate. But because the story involves a barrel, he becomes the patron saint of brewers.
Oh my goodness.
Isn't that great? I love those connections. Like I tell you, we're following this rabbit hole. And so that was one little branch off.
Yeah.
Where Saint Nicholas got part of his credentials was based upon this story. So this evil butcher, feel free to jump in at any time if there's anything to throw in here. This evil butcher becomes part of the tradition, kind of in North France, Northeast France, into Belgium, Switzerland, kind of a French speaking, the French speaking people around Belgium and Switzerland, kind of in that border area. And this story goes back, or the evil butcher goes back to at least the 1200s, and where this reformed butcher becomes part of the companions of Saint Nicholas. And you can actually, there is a Wikipedia page where you can actually look up companions of Santa Claus, I think it is. And you'll find a list of at least probably 10 different characters with very similar personalities and jobs, where this rabbit hole is going down. Now this evil butcher becomes known in France as Père Foutard, excuse my French again, otherwise known as Father Whipper. And this is, the tradition goes that Father Whipper, travels with Saint Nick on Saint Nicholas Day, which is December 6th. This is kind of the feast day for for the original saint.
Yeah.
The third and fourth century saint, tradition goes, he died on December 6th. So that's become his feast day. More of a European tradition than we find over here. But Father Whipper comes along with Saint Nick, and originally he's kind of depicted as this kind of scraggly, black robed Santa. So he's kind of Santa's evil twin. And you see these in a lot of these companion stories, is that, Santa is kind of the good guy in the story, giving gifts to good kids. A variety of different varieties, where Father Whipper or these other companions that we'll get to come along to punish naughty kids. And we're not talking about just coal in the stocking kind of punishing. Yeah. Oftentimes these characters will come along with switches or with branches to beat the kids. They'll come along with bags to carry the kids off.
What a way to terrify a child. We tell them they won't get a good present in their stocking. And over there, back in the 1200s, they tell them that if you're not good, you get kidnapped by this evil whipping monster.
Yeah. This is more than just Grinch territory. Oh, yeah. Grinch is pretty tame according to, when you look at these guys, And yeah, this might be where you want to be watching the kind of the video version of this, because I'll pop up some images of some of these characters that we're going through. And yeah, these aren't friendly looking people or creatures that they're depicted. And so later on, he goes from kind of black robe Santa, as it were, and he becomes depicted more as actually being black. And this, it becomes similar to another one of kind of these traditional companions of Santa Claus, known as Black Pete. And this is more of a Dutch tradition. So the other one is kind of more of a French tradition. This is kind of a Dutch variety of it. From at least the 18th century. I think it goes back much further. Again, it's really hard to kind of pin down when these characters first appeared on the scene.
Yeah.
They're usually kind of an outgrowth or kind of a collection of time merging into to kind of creating some of these characters. Black Pete, I'm not even going to try pronouncing the, Zwarte Piet, something like that. Zwarte Piet. He's a companion. And one story, at least one origin, is that this Black Pete was actually originally a demon that was tamed by Saint Nick. And that's kind of a common theme with some of these other ones, is that they're kind of start as demons, but then are somehow tamed or harnessed by Saint Nick and become kind of the evil companion. And initially, actually, in kind of the Dutch tradition, Santa Claus or Saint Nick or Sinterklaas was kind of portrayed, had more of that strict kind of disciplinarian aside to him.
Right.
Before that, those kind of characteristics were kind of transferred over to these other companions. So Black Pete became this kind of more of the Punisher, as it were. Again, very similar to Father Whipper. He would punish the kind of the naughty kids. And the fun thing about him, as time has gone on, and as you might already sense, given our own cultural moment, the term Black Pete is not so embraced. At least that's what we're told. At least that's where we're at least that's where some protests have arisen. Black Pete isn't as popular.
Yeah.
And so more recently he's kind of sanitized and called Sooty Pete. So he's black. Initially the black, they're not sure. He first kind of depicted it in the 1850s by a school teacher as having dark skin, black, being black in character. And that might have been based upon the Spanish Moors. So these would be the kind of the African Muslims that had come up centuries before. At least that's where that's where the Moors came from. And so they had the kind of the darker skin tones. And perhaps that was where that original depiction was based on. Over time now, I guess it's okay to have... Well, so what would happen is Black Pete would be portrayed in blackface because that's the character.
Yeah.
But obviously, like I said, that's frowned upon nowadays.
Culturally not acceptable now.
Yeah. And so now, but if you call yourself Sooty Pete, you can put black stuff on your face, but maybe not as black, but
it's soot from the chimney.
Exactly. Right.
There you go.
Yeah. Here. We're getting around this. So you're not dressing up in blackface. You just got soot on your face.
Dressing up in dirty face.
Yeah. I don't know what the difference is. But generally Sooty Pete is considered more acceptable nowadays. In fact, I'll have to rewatch it. I have the series of The Office on DVD. I know there's a Halloween scene in one episode that they've cut from the DVD version that was initially aired. I remember that.
Yeah.
But another scene, I'll have to double check whether it's still in there. But I bet you if you streamed it, it's not there. There's an episode where one of the characters at one of the Christmas parties, again, I didn't look up the episode that's on. I should have. Actually, it might be Dwight Christmas. It might be Dwight Christmas, because that we'll tie this back in to our next character. Remember, we're going down this rabbit hole. We got to make connections here. All these connections.
Everything ties together.
Yeah. There's a Black Pete character on one of the episodes of The Office, and it's only a brief scene, if I recall it. I only remember it because I had no idea why that character is even there. It's just so weird.
Yeah.
To see him dressed a guy in blackface like that. It was Black Pete, and I didn't know it at the time.
If you don't have connections to the Dutch tradition, especially based on our Christmas traditions and our understanding of Santa Claus and everything in North America.
Yeah, we got Coca-Cola Santa.
That is pretty unusual. Yeah, our Santa is just big jolly guy with the red suit, and his only friends are a bunch of elves.
Yeah, he's pretty tame over here.
Yeah,
I'm liking this European culture here. This kind of the European storyline to Santa,
demons and guys who whip children.
Yeah,
it's scary.
I love the conflict. It's much more engaging. You know, it just creates a lot more
good
interest.
Versus evil.
That's right. Even more funny is than The Office trying to get rid of Black Pete is that over the last decade in Dutch, there's been clashes between anti-Pete and pro-Pete groups. So there's people clashing over this Christmas character.
Yeah.
And sometimes violently. If I think most notably in 2017 and 18, there's clashes between these anti and pro-Pete groups in the Netherlands.
What a thing to fight over.
Yeah,
but it's tradition. It's hard to just drop something that's been tradition for many, many years. Like this says, what was it, 1850?
At least
was the first time he was illustrated. Illustrated,
yeah.
So it's been around for a while.
Yeah. And actually, he's up until the last few years, he was actually very popular still with the Dutch, like 80% approval rate as far as people. I think that's come down a little bit as kind of the cultural events and tide has kind of crashed a little bit more on European shores from North America. We're sorry about that. Some of the things that are happening in North America, I think are affecting some of the perceptions over there now, as far as this kind of black characters, black face, but he's still much more popular than he is, maligned, as much as these clashes might indicate their opposition. So we got Father Whipper, we got Black Pete, and I know we're gonna run a little bit long, but we'll wrap up with one more with Belschnickel. And then remember, here's a tie-in, because first of all, the tie-in is he's just another one of these kind of companions of Santa characters. But Belschnickel was also depicted in Dwight Christmas in one of the Office episodes. Dwight Schrute, if you're a fan of The Office, and really, if who isn't? You probably, I don't think so, right? You haven't got into it.
I don't watch the show.
No. Oh, we can't all be perfect, I guess. I don't know. But anyways, we got, he dresses up as Belschnickel, and it's kind of this woodland creature with twigs kind of sprouting out of his head. Kind of portrayal, and when you look at the other pictures, that's what Belschnickel is. This comes more from a German tradition. This character, again, he has kind of the punishing role of punishing naughty kids, but he more than the others, he actually does have some reward properties with him. He does carry around like cakes with him. Pockets full of cakes, candies, and nuts for good children. So he treads into a little bit of the Santa territory. He goes by Belschnickel. Other names, Kris Kringle. So very similar to kind of the Kris Kringle version of it. He doesn't travel with Saint Nick like the other ones do. The other ones come along with them, kind of on usually around Saint Nicholas Day. Belschnickel comes in before Christmas and kind of checks in on the kids and carries them off if need be, or delivers treats to the good ones. But Belschnickel would be kind of a more of a German tradition. And then, yeah, there's just so many more other ones. Krampus is another one we probably won't get to, but I'll just worth mentioning, just because this Krampus is again more of kind of on the demon side of things.
Yeah.
He doesn't. I don't think he has any redeeming properties, whereas Belschnickel has just at least a little bit. Krampus is more Austrian. The articles were saying Alpine kind of tradition to him. With him, the Austrians actually made Christmas cards with him on it in the late 1800s, early 1900s.
Yeah, just thinking about that, you getting a Christmas card with this picture of this like black hairy demon with horns and saying
red tongue sticking out,
greetings from Krampus.
Yeah,
that's that is a whole nother thing.
Gotta check out the video episode. Otherwise. Of this podcast. Otherwise, I'll try to put some of the links up. There's just so many places I went with this rabbit hole. If you get a chance, I'll put a link up for Grilla and her 13 sons and their cat. So she is the what was it? She was the Christmas witch.
Yes,
From Iceland.
Iceland.
This is the Iceland tradition, and it's worth looking up because she has 13 sons, and it's kind of like a perverted view of the 12 or the seven dwarfs, because there are 13 sons all have these different names based upon what they do. There's a couple here that's worth looking up. There's a spoon licker, pot scraper, bowl licker. These are some of the names of Gorilla's sons. Sausage swiper is another one. Doorway sniffer. So this has to do with kind of apparently in Iceland they make this leaf bread. It's like some sort of Icelandic Christmas bread, and this doorway sniffer smells it out. Candle stealer, like, so just some really good ones. And then the Yule cat, who's kind of her pet, the pet of Gorilla. If you're looking for a little bit different angle on Christmas traditions, take a look at some of these European traditions, because we have really sanitized and polished up our Santa Claus over here.
Yeah.
Far beyond what maybe the original Saint Nick was, and then certainly a lot more sanitized than what the European traditions are. So if the song about Santa Claus checking his list twice seems a little harsh to you,
fear getting cold, just look at the European traditions. You'll feel so much better about our glamorized Santa tradition.
You really have to see some visual depictions of some of these creatures to really get a full appreciation of what we're talking about. But anyways, thank you. Yeah, this is hopefully this was as entertaining for you as it was for me to go down these rabbit holes. Like I said, this is a much lighter, more trivial view, but hopefully as well gave you just a little bit more information about something. At least I don't know what use it is.
Learn a little more about the world.
Purely entertainment, yeah. Broaden your Santa Claus horizon a little bit more. Thank you for joining us. Again, we'll hopefully be back in the new year. We thank you for joining us along with these 10 episodes. Let us know what you've thought about this. Like I said, we're just kind of winging this and seeing what sticks and what kind of works. So let us know your thoughts and what you think about this going forward. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. My name is Brian Constein.
And I'm Michael Rowland.
And this has been Penhold Talk Radio.